Hi, everybody. My name is Arsene. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I'm really glad to be here. Wasn't quite sure if we were going to make it or not. Kobani, you ever been there before? Yes. And then when we finally pull in and we see the building, she goes, "There it is." You know, so I was like, yeah, I couldn't miss it either. But we did. We had an absolutely wonderful, great time, and I wasn't in her little van with her, and we were bebopping down here, and we were just yakking away, and that we got lost didn't really surprise me because we were talking so much. I was sure we just kind of just drove by past we were going, and I got to wear my dress that I brought tonight, but I almost didn't because I got a call, and when we were driving here, my husband called me on my cell phone to tell me that he had found sitting on the dining room floor my luggage keys. You know, so, but we pulled into the handy dandy gas station, and sure enough, there's a guy in a truck with bolt cutters, and so he just cut that little puppy off for me, and we were on our way. And then Bonnie and I were talking that we thought he must be an AA because we were both very attracted to the guy. So, just that little something about them makes you look over your shoulder. But it's an honor and a privilege to be here, and I want to thank Stephanie and the committee for asking me to come. I know Stephanie and I are definitely somewhat alike. We have to be because I've probably gotten about 12 letters from Stephanie, and she's very thorough in making sure. Every month I got the phone bill, the gas bill, and a letter from Stephanie, you know, and in November, the phone bill, a gas bill, and a letter from Stephanie, and it's great. It's nice to, you know, a lot of times you go to these things and you don't know anything that's going on, and she made sure I knew what was happening here, and I really do appreciate it. And, you know, when I saw your program, you've just got a slate full of just absolutely wonderful people. It's been my privilege to speak with most of them at other deals, and Mickey, you know, who I love very much, and Bob, and Kay, and AJ, who I know as well, and I know you have an Alateen speaker, Brittany, that's just wonderful, you know. And I mean, they're all just absolutely wonderful, neat, terrific people who, you know, just like me, you know, just doing the best we can one day at a time. And, you know, and it's so wonderful to have a place like this to come to get that I get to meet these people and count them among my friends. You know, that's not anything that I wanted when I got here. What I wanted when I got here was for everybody just to be quiet. You know, just no more talking, no more doing stuff. Everybody, shh, no talking. And for me, that's really because I'm a yakker. You know, it was bad enough. I had to fly out here on a 4-hour plane flight next to a guy who didn't want to talk. You know, for me to be quiet for 4 hours is almost an act of God, let me tell you. And it was really hard, and I kept trying to talk to him even though he wasn't very sociable. But anyway, I've had a great time so far, and I'm really, really glad to be here, and I'll settle down in just a minute. Still a little bit hyper from everything going on, but again, it's a real honor and a privilege to be here. And I'm just going to leap into it and tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me now. I'm the oldest of four kids. My dad was a master sergeant in the Army, so that made me the automatic corporal of my family. From the very beginning, I've been in charge of somebody or something. That's just the way it's always been for me. My husband jokes that I came out of the womb carrying a clipboard and wearing an armband, you know, and he's not too far off the mark. You know, all going through school, I was always room monitor, cafeteria monitor, playground monitor, because, you know, I don't care. If you do something wrong, I'm going to write your name down and report you to the proper authorities. You know, I don't care if you're in the sixth grade and bigger than me. You know, I'm writing your name down, and that's just the way it is. And, you know, what can I say? You know, those things just don't scare me. It's a gift. I just don't know what else to say. And, you know, and if you're going to marry an alcoholic, boy, now there are some people who need to be written down and reported to the proper authorities. I mean, they're always doing stuff they're not supposed to be doing, and why that attracts me so much, I have no idea. It's hard for me not to just keep watching Mickey real close right now, but shouldn't be crossing your legs that long. It's bad for your circulation. But anyway, I grew up in this military family, and my dad ran our family just like he ran his outfits in the Army. We had room inspections. We had little Army blankets on our beds. We had little foot lockers at the end of our bed where we stowed our stuff. And, you know, my dad came in and did white glove stuff, and he popped quarters on our, you know, beds to make sure they bounce and all that stuff. And I loved it. I just love the whole thing. I love all the rules. I love all the regulations. I like knowing what is exactly expected of you and what you have to do to perform, you know, to get that gold star by your name. That's what I want to know. Show me. I'm a rule and regulation person, and I learned that really, really early on. You know, and I grew up in a family where my dad drank every day, and I had absolutely no idea that my dad's drinking was a problem in our family. You know, I didn't know that because that's just the way it was when I came into that family. My dad drank every day. My dad got drunk every day. And, you know, and how are you supposed to know that's different from what's supposed to be? I just thought that's what dads did. And, you know, and growing up in the military, we always lived with other military families and military housing, and all their dads drank, you know, and there was always all kinds of fighting going on and all kinds of stuff and people getting in trouble, and, you know, and lots of moms had black eyes, and, you know, that was just the way that it was. And to me, it was absolutely normal behavior, you know, and as my sponsor says, you know, and I have really come to believe that I have heard in Al-Anon, you know, it's just normal behavior in an alcoholic home. It's really no big deal. And just to quickly describe to you kind of like what it was like growing up in my home. You know, when I was very new in Al-Anon, I went to a heck of a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, open speaker meetings, you know. And if you're new in Al-Anon, and even if you're not, you know, I can't recommend enough to me the importance of going to open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. You know, it says in our Al-Anon literature that we should learn all we can about the disease of alcoholism. You know, and to me, there's no better place to learn that than in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a lot of open AA meetings, and I heard one speaker when I was very new in the program, and that AA speaker that night talked about alcoholism, the family disease. You know, and I don't know if that's what his whole pitch was, but that's what I heard. That's what I heard him talk about. And he talked about alcoholism, the family disease, like in your home. And it's like you have this rhinoceros in your living room, but everybody pretends it's a coffee table. You know, and that's the perfect description of the family that I grew up in, because, you know, my mom would get to the point where she could tell where my dad was ready to have one of his alcoholic explosions, and she could never say to us kids, okay, kids, your dad's going to blow here any money, so don't anybody do anything, because, of course, that would cause him to have an alcoholic explosion. So, you know, and if you grow up in an alcoholic home, you know, one of the first things that goes out of the windows is, like, verbal communication, and if you grew up in a house like I did, you know, we don't talk to each other, but we do use a lot of facial movements, which have a lot of significance, you know. And again, if you grew up in an alcoholic home, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And when somebody's doing a lot of this, you know there's trouble coming around the corner. I mean, you know, you kind of take notice. And we'd be sitting around the dinner table, and my mom would start giving her eye signals. And what all of us kids would, you know, intuitively know, do nothing, say nothing, everybody be quiet. You could cut the tension in that house with a knife. But, you know, sure enough, if you've got an alcoholic who's going to explode, you know, it's going to happen. And, you know, and somebody would do something minor, some infraction, spill some milk, you know, scrape a knife on a plate. It didn't matter what it was. And sure enough, boom, you know, and dinner would go flying, and everybody would get a spanking, everybody would be sent off to bed, and this could be 5:30 in the afternoon, and, you know, we'd all be in bed crying and sniveling, including my mom. Everybody's got to go, you know, and then the next morning we get up, and, you know, we finally get the courage to creep down the hallway and walk into the kitchen, and there's my dad sitting with his, you know, morning breakfast beer, and you walk into the kitchen, and it's, good morning, what do you want for breakfast? And no one ever said, gee whiz, Dad, what was that about last night? Gee whiz, Dad, how come you had to throw dinner on the floor? Gee whiz, Dad, how come you had to hit everybody? Because you just want it to be over, and the rhinoceros just goes back to being a coffee table, and you hope today's going to be different. You know, and that pretty much describes what it was like growing up in the house that I grew up in. And, you know, and we moved a lot because we were in the Army, and that's just kind of what you do. But, you know, like I say, I learned early on, you know, find out the rules and regulations. Do your best in school. Get straight A's. Be the very best at whatever you do, and keep your nose clean, and the Sarge won't be down your case so much. You know, and I was quick, and I picked up on that really easily. You know, I wish I could say my two younger sisters and my brother would, but they didn't. And they took a lot more beatings at my father's hands than I ever did. You know, and again, you know, my perception of how it was growing up, I'm sure that theirs is slightly different. You know, they always look at me like Dad's favorite. And, again, you know, everybody that, you know, when I talk to other kids growing up in alcoholic homes, you know, everybody's got their own different experience, where you are in your hierarchy of the family and who's doing what and, you know, whatever it all works out. You know, all I know is that, you know, is that I'm an Al-Anon today. And I don't have to live in all that past stuff anymore and wonder why and how come and why was this and why wasn't this and how come my dad, you know, was a violent alcoholic and other people aren't. And, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. All I know is that it's all pretty typical. You know, the bottom line is the feelings and how I felt about it when I got here. You know, and because we have steps and sponsorship and traditions to work, you know, that I do in my life, you know, I'm able to enjoy my life today, and I don't have to live in a, you know, in a childhood that I resent and look back on, you know, as a real negative thing. I did a lot of work in that area, you know, and I'm free of it today, and I am so grateful, and I got that here, a very, very precious, precious gift to me. But anyway, as we were getting older, it got really hard to date in my house because my dad had a lot of rules and regulations about dating. And when I was 12, my dad got out of the military and we moved to California. Now, we'd always lived on the East Coast in military housing, but to come to California, and this was in the late 60s, so it was really hippy-dippy time, you know, it was just like moving to, like, Mars for us. It was just unbelievable. And we get to California, you know, and now we're starting to become teenage girls, and so we're starting to want to go out with boys. And like I say, it's very, very hard to go out in my house because my dad has a lot of rules and regulations about dating, and I follow every single one of them. And you got to bring the little weenie guy home to meet dad. And my dad is over 6 foot tall, and he has one eyebrow. He can raise like 6 inches above his forehead, you know. So when he's standing over you, he looks like the devil himself. You know, when my dad yelled, I mean, people would pee their pants, grown men, on the spot. You know, he was a master sergeant in the Army. He knew what to do and how to do it and how to look at you and how to intimidate the crap out of you. And so we'd bring these little weenie guys home, and my dad would stand over them and tell them the rules and regulations of dating his daughter, you know, and it'd be, where are you going, when are you going to be back, and what part of their anatomy he would remove if we were not returned in the virginal condition of which we left the house in the first place. So, you know, subsequently, very, very hard to get a second date at my house. I mean, darn near impossible. You know, guys would take you home early, shake your hand at the door, thank you very much, but nobody's worth this, you know, and that would kind of be the deal. And so it was hard, you know, and I know my mom did the very best she could trying to deal with my dad and, you know, and all that stuff that was going on and trying to raise three girls and let them have some kind of a semblance of a life. And, you know, so my mom just ended up lying for us all the time and covering us up, you know, so that we could go out and meet friends and do things or whatever, you know. And the alcoholism in the house that I grew up in gets progressively worse as the disease does. And you learn, you know, fairly early on not to be bringing friends home from school because you never know what kind of situation you're going to walk into when you walk in the door. Because sometimes you can come home and Sarge is just in a great mood and he's just, you know, as cheerful and wonderful and happy as he can be. And the next day you can walk in with the same exact friend and now you're an idiot and you're stupid and all kinds of names I can't say from this podium, you know. And if you ever, you know, get an award at school, you know, you learn not to tell your parents that, because if you've ever had a drunk dad show up at a school function, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is just not reserved from the alcoholic. You know, I've been embarrassed to tears by my dad's behavior at school things, and again, it's just what goes with the disease of alcoholism. It's just what goes with it. You know, what I know today from doing a fourth and a fifth step and working the other steps is that my dad was alcoholic. He's a sick person. My dad died when he was 55 from the disease of alcoholism. You know, my dad died the horrible death that they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, total insanity and death. And that's just what it was. I can't even tell you from this podium the last words my dad said to me. He was strapped down in restraints and just nothing but foul garbage. It was like a scene from The Exorcist when I was in that hospital room with him. And I'd only been in Al-Anon at that point a very, very short amount of time, maybe 6 months. And I wasn't to the loving and kind portion of the program yet at that point. You know, and my attitude was I was glad he was dying. He couldn't die fast enough for me. Because I just thought, you know what, when he's dead, it'll be done for me. You know, that'll just be over. And he did die, and it wasn't over for me. And I had to do a lot of work on that stuff. But this is where we come to get to learn about what recovery is really about. You know, you have a choice to stay in the disease and the illness. Even when the people are gone, you know, they still have that way of coming back from the grave and grabbing back at you. If you don't have a program to put into place and things to work. You know, because of Al-Anon, because of going to so many Alcoholics Anonymous meetings today, I know that my dad was a sick person and that, you know, he was racked with the disease of alcoholism, and I know that that he loved me as best as he was able. When I was doing my work on my dad, I was having a really difficult time, and my sponsor just gave me one assignment. She says, I want you to think about one good thing your dad did for you. You know, and at that point it was really hard because, see, for me, alcoholism is a really negative disease. All I ever see is the black. the negative part. That's just how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I'm not even the person that drinks. But that's all I could see. But she made me look and look and think and think and think until I finally came up with that he taught me how to drive. You know, which if you're going to marry your own alcoholic is a very essential quality to be able to have. So I finally came up with something. I said, he taught me how to drive. You know, and because I'd done so much work and I'd written about it, you know, and done all the things I was supposed to do, it was now time to let go. You know, and her way of teaching me how to let go was, you know, you've talked about it, we've worked it out, it was the way that it was. You know, life can't be undone. You need to move on and you need to forgive. And so, and she says, and the way for me to forgive was every time that I would think about those bad feelings would start to bubble up in me again, all I would think about is I would just replace that with what I was grateful for, that my dad taught me how to drive. You know, and it, because I'm taking a positive, you know, a positive thought instead of the negative road, you know, then I came up with a second thing that my dad did, and then I came up with a third thing that my dad did, and a fourth thing that my dad did that I was grateful for. You know, but the disease of alcoholism doesn't want you to see any of the good stuff going on in your life. It just wants you to see that long, dark tunnel. You know, and my sponsor took me there. And I don't mean to stand before you today and tell you, you know, that Al-Anon's taught me, you know, that everything that went down when I was a kid was perfectly okay and now it's time to move on. It's not okay. It's not okay to grow up in an alcoholic home and be physically abused in any way, shape, or form. But what is what is. And then when do you move past it and when do you move on so that you can be happy, joyous, and free? And that's what Al-Anon has taught me, that I can be happy, joyous, and free if I want to. You know, and I'm very, very grateful to a sponsor that was so willing to work with me on all those things. But anyway, when I was 17 years old, I met my husband. I should have known there was something really wrong with him because my dad liked him right away. You know, my dad never liked anybody right away, but he liked him right away. But that went right over my head. And I went on this date with him, and we went with this other couple, and, you know, and my husband is about 8 years older than I am, so he was like 23 years old, and you know, and this might have been clue number two to me that there was something wrong, because he'd been married once before, but he was back living with his mom and dad. But that one went right over my head too. And we went on this date, and we went bowling, and I tried not to beat him at bowling, but it was almost impossible. And I just cleaned his clock. Just got that. I'm just so competitive. And after we went bowling, we were going back to his house with this other couple, and he stopped at a liquor store, and he'd asked me what I'd like to drink. Well, you know, I'm 17 years old. It's not legal to drink in the state of California, you know, so I tell him the rules and regulations about drinking in California, you know, but that didn't bother him at all, surprise, surprise, you know, and he went in and got a gallon of Red Mountain wine, if nothing else, to impress me what he could consume in sheer volume alone in one evening. And, you know, and so we went back to his house with this other couple, you know, and after we played this game for a little while, I started drinking a little bit of this wine, and I ended up getting probably drunk, I guess is the best word to say for it. That's exactly what it was, and first time that had ever happened to me and that I'd ever done anything like that. You know, and now I can stand before you today and tell you, you know, what the feelings that I think about that first date that I went out with him and the alcohol and the drinking is, what a great time I had. I had a ball. It was the most relaxed evening I'd ever had in my entire life. You know, and he was probably 10 times drunker than I was, but he was a fun guy. I'd never been around fun drinkers. You know, I'd only been around evil, bad, mad, you know, crazy, fighting, kicking type stuff. This was an entirely different experience for me. And then when he was driving me home, you know, he had his hands in the proper 3 o'clock position on the steering wheel, you know, which showed me, you know, that he could handle what he was doing and everything was going to be just fine. And, you know, we pretty much started dating exclusively from that point on. It was really difficult to date Butch, basically, because he could never remember my name. But, you know, if you want to date an alcoholic, you can't let the fact that they can't remember your name deter you, you know, or you're not going to get very far. You know, I know my name is different, and, you know, and I haven't hardly met any other Larcenes. And I asked my dad, because my dad is the one that gave me the name Larcene, and I was one time prodding him about, you know, where he got the name from, and he said it was the name of a town in Scotland. Now, I have written to Scotland, looked on the internet, you know, had people who were going to Scotland check it out for me. No one has found any place in Scotland named Larcene. Now, my dad is very Scottish, and he's very, very proud of it, you know, so I finally deduced that what Larcene really means is that father was drunk when daughter was born, so daughter got stuck with weird name, and that's his alcoholic explanation for it. And but anyway, it was hard to date my husband, and you know, and we went out a lot, and we partied hardy, and it was a great time, and I was having a great time, and he was having a good time, and I didn't go on any date with him that did not involve drinking. I mean, it was just right up there in my face, this is what he did. He also did a heck of a lot of drugs going on and all that other kind of stuff, and, you know, that was all his thing, and, you know, but he was always right there in my face with what he was doing, and, you know, shooting things in his veins, sorting things up his nose. He didn't care. You know, I mean, he'd take six and then ask what it was. And that's just the way that he was. And, you know, and I share this with you because later on, you know, when I walked into Al-Anon the very first time, if you would have said to me, Larsine, did you have any idea that Butch was drinking as much as he was drinking and that he was doing drugs and, you know, illegal drugs on top of that? You know, I would have said the day that I walked into Al-Anon that I had absolutely no idea that he was doing that. Even though I told you that from the very beginning, you know, he never hid it from me, never pretended that he didn't do it. It was part from the very, very beginning. But again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I'm not even the person that's drinking. You know, and that's just, you know, what we talk about in our literature, denial. When it gets too hard for me to look at, then I just pretend it's not even there anymore. You know, I just pretended that he just never did that. You know, one more time, it's so important for me to be the innocent victim here. I really didn't know when I knew from the very beginning. You know, and again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I don't even know what's happening. I don't even know that right from the very beginning that I'm being changed by somebody else's drinking. I think I'm hanging in there. I think I'm tough. I think all kinds of things, but I don't think that I'm being affected, you know. And I think the part, you know, that in Al-Anon when we talk about the denial, how important that is. You know, I was here for so long before I could even see past my part in so many things that happened, totally blocked off to me. You know, again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and the worst part of it is that I don't even know it, don't even have a clue. You know, and anyway, we were dating, we were having a great time, we went out for a couple of years, and my husband was a blackout drinker from the very beginning, a disappearing drunk from the very beginning, and, you know, but none of this I didn't think I couldn't fix. I knew that I could fix all of it, and I didn't have any concerns about any of it. And what ended up happening is after we dated for a couple of years, I ended up getting pregnant. You know, and I share this with you because later on, again, when the drinking got really, really bad, you know, I was sure it was because God was punishing me, because I'm the big rule follower and the big regulation person, and now I've broken the big rule and the big regulation, and this is the punishment from above. You know, I had to be in an Al-Anon for a while before I finally figured out, you know, if you're going to screw around and not use any birth control, you might just get pregnant. You know, just a fact of life. But, you know, here I am one more time, my denial, and, you know, and my having to justify what's happening to me to make it be okay in my own head. Because if God's punishing you, what defense do you have? How can you make anything be different in your life if that's your cross to bear? You know, and again, I get these ideas. I liken them to ideas from nowhere, you know. I think up crap, and just because I think it up and it lands here, for some reason, it becomes fact for me. You know, and if it's fact for me, then it's fact for you too, you know, and that's just the way that it is. And, you know, I have absolutely, you know, God never said to me, Larsine, I'm punishing you. Larsine, this is going to be your punishment. But I decided that that was the deal. And that way, see, I don't have to take responsibility for it. God's punishing me. But anyway, Butch and I got married a month after our child was born, and this was a huge deal for me. I don't care if you think it's a big deal or not. For me, it was a huge deal. And occasionally I'd have to take Butch to these work functions with me, and all the way to this work function I would tell Butch, now if they ask you what year we got married, you tell them blah, 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 so that it works out in the chronological order that I know you so desperately want it to work out in. You know, but I've yet to be to a party yet where they go, Butch, it's nice to meet you. What year did you and Larsine get married, you know? No one ever seems to think about that stuff to the degree that we think that they think about it. But anyway, huge, huge deal for me. When I was my first year in Al-Anon, in Southern California, we have the Al-Anon Family Groups Convention. And what we used to do, you know, when we all used to go as a group all the time, is we just get as many women as we could get to go to this set, the conference. And we get two adjoining hotel rooms and just cram it full. And one night after, you know, after the big meetings, we were up in the room and we were having the meeting after the meeting. And there's seven of us in the room and we're all sitting around. And it seems to me what I'm hearing sharing is everybody telling their deepest, darkest secret. Now, I don't know that that's what they were saying, but again, that's what I heard. And so when it came around my turn to share, I shared with them how I had had to get married because I was pregnant. And now there's seven of us in the room. Turns out six of them had to get married because they were pregnant. And we decided the seventh was the sickest because she married an alcoholic and didn't have to. And so you do get to learn in here. You are as sick as your secrets. Trust me on that. But you know, for a long, long time, that was a huge deal for me. Absolutely unbearable. You know, to the point that this little boy, when his birthday would come around, would make me so uncomfortable. So uncomfortable because, see, he was the big lie. He was the big lie I had to tell everybody. And again, the way I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, I take the big lie and I put it off on this little child. Absolutely no business doing that. Not that I made his birthdays miserable or did anything like that, but inside I didn't like it. When his birthday would start coming up, I would start getting just that awful feeling, you know, and it's garbage in, garbage out. And again, one more time, coming to Al-Anon to learn how to love my own family, you know, to let my past be just that, to let my mistakes be just that, you know, and I can't look at that child, you know, he's 28 years old today, and he's anything but a mistake. You know, but left to my own devices and my own information from nowhere, I go to the negative side and I make it be a bad thing. You know, I come to Al-Anon and I find out it's a wonderful thing and it's a terrific thing and he's a wonderful man today and I love him with all my heart. You know, and I got that from you guys and how grateful I am. But anyway, we were married a month after our son was born, so I could tell people I wasn't pregnant when I got married because I wasn't. And I wasn't. You know, you figure it out, but that's not my problem. And I want you to know that up until the day that Butch and I got married, I never said one word to him about all the drugs he was doing and all the drinking he was doing and the fact that he hardly ever went to work. I never said one word to him at all until the day after we got married. The day after we got married, I sat him down in the kitchen chair and told him the rules and regulations of the marriage. You know, and I remember him sitting in the chair and I told him once a month we were going to get a babysitter. But that was it. Other than that, we got to work, we got to save money, we got to buy a house, we have a child, we have responsibility, we have obligations, this party-hardy stuff is over, you know, and this is the way it's going to be. And I said, do you understand the rules and regulations of the marriage? And he did this, which was acknowledging to me that he fully understand and was willing to abide by them. You know, until day number three of our marriage, and I kid you not one bit, day number three of our marriage, he does not come home all night long. You know, now I know today the reason that his head was going like this is because he was so flaming loaded. That's just all he could be doing, you know, but I didn't know that at the time. And, you know, and day number three is when war got declared. I mean, I watched my mom for years say nothing, so I knew the silent treatment didn't work. You know, I am proud, proud to stand before you today, tell you my husband begged for the silent treatment. He never got it, not one time. I am one of those Al-Anons whose mouth is attached to the doorknob that you have heard talk about. Boy, the minute he would come in the door, just screaming and hollering and cursing and cussing. And, you know, and I don't know why, you know, and I was a huge curser. Huge, huge. I just don't even ask me where the words came from or the combination of phrases. But, you know, again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, the anger from the very, very beginning was there for me. It was just sitting right there, just waiting for someone like Butch to hatch it right out. You know, and he would walk in the door and I would just curse at him and yell at him. And I don't know why I thought, but in some, you know, fiber of my being, again, information from nowhere, that if I just cursed at him with the right mothers and F-words in the right sequential order, like he would have this spiritual awakening, you know. Like, all our scene, you know. Since such a sweet girl like you would cuss so profoundly, you know, my behavior must be affecting you, and I will stop that behavior immediately, you know, like he was going to have this kind of revelation. But anyway, you know, and he was just, you know, he was the easygoing guy. He just liked to lay down, he'd get drunk, lay down, pass out. That was Butch's idea of a good time. There would be no yelling and screaming in the house at all if it wasn't for me. You know, I shared that one time about him just wanting to get drunk, lay down, pass out, and he was sitting in the front row and a guy in AA was sitting next to him, and the guy in AA sitting next to him leaned over to Butch and said, "Butch, I don't think that's too much to ask for." You know, but it was way, way more than I could give him. You know, he jokes that part of the reason that I talk as fast as I do is I only had so much time from when he came home to when he passed out to tell him everything it was. But by God, he was going to hear it. You know, he'd be passing out, I'd be picking him up by the shoulders and shaking him, you know, "I'm not done yet," you know, and just telling him some more stuff about what a no good blah, 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 blah. You know, and I know that's all he heard was blah, 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 blah. My husband was a blackout drinker, and he's very, very grateful for it, I guess. But, you know, blackout drinking, how do you know blackout drinking? They're walking, they're talking, they're moving, they're doing stuff. I mean, I had no idea he wasn't present. You know, I mean, holy mackerel, I would have saved myself and just kicked him right from the beginning and been done with it. But, you know, I have, you know, again, I don't know. I have no idea what I'm dealing with, but it never occurs to me to ask anybody what's going on in my house. You know, it never occurs to me that what's going on in my house is similar to what was going on in the house that I grew up in. You know, I always said, you know, I married an alcoholic, you know, or like my father is, but that's where the differences between the two of them were. Where my dad was a very violent, angry alcoholic who took it out on us. My husband was not. He was just Mr. Happy Guy. You know, just like I say, lay down, pass out, whatever. But I just couldn't have it. I just couldn't stand for it, went out one little bit. It would just drive me absolutely crazy. You know, and I want you to know that when Butch and I got married, the absolute driving force behind that was the fact that we had a child. That's the truth. That's the reason that we got married. But I also want you to know that when Butch and I got married, that the day we took our vows, that he was sober, you know, and I was present there. And that when, you know, we talked about that we wanted to love each other and cherish each other and honor each other, you know, and take care of each other till death do us part, that I believe with all my heart that we were both as sincere as any two people could be when they took those vows. You know, but I'm here to tell you that, you know, it wasn't just Butch and Larsine that got married that day. It was also the disease of alcoholism. You know, and alcoholism doesn't love or cherish or honor anything. It means to tear your family apart. It means to tear the alcoholic apart. It means to get as many family members as it can along the way, because that's the disease of alcoholism, and that's just the way that it works. You know, and to think that we're not affected because we're not the drinkers. You know, it's to me, you know, the most difficult thing that I had to overcome when I got here, because I really felt like it's not my fault. I was really big on whose fault it was. And again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, how my thinking is affected by the disease of alcoholism. But anyway, Butch and I set off on this very happy, wonderful marriage right from the very beginning. And, you know, like I say, it was war from the start. I know my husband tried many times to hold it together and do the stuff that he was supposed to do, you know, but Larsine is on watch 24/7, you know, and you can't get too far off the path without me seeing it before I'm not going to come down on you just as hard as I can. You know, and I was the yeller, and I was the screamer, and I was the hollerer, and, you know, and again, alcoholism is a progressive disease, and it got progressively worse in our house, and again, I have absolutely no idea, you know, that I'm dealing with alcoholism. And my husband comes home one night very, very late, and to show you how drunk he was, he wakes me up. You know, which is unheard of. You know, and he shook me, and he demanded to have his dinner. Now, he'd never done anything like that before, and it kind of startled me. So I kind of got up, scurried off into the kitchen. But then after I was in the kitchen for a few minutes and I was waking up, I was remembering who he was dealing with. And I'd made this Mexican casserole that night that called for one jalapeno pepper, but of course I had a whole can full of them. You know, so I just cut up every single one of those leftover jalapeno peppers and just stuffed it in there. You know, when he ate it, his mouth must have been on flaming fire, you know, but he's so drunk he ate it all. And then he did what I wanted him to do, and that was go in the bathroom and puke his brains out. You know, because I don't know how you feel, but when my alcoholic throws up, I get a warm feeling all over. It just lasts me for days. You know, it's just like, and here he is puking his brains out, you know, and I'm in the bedroom giggling in my pillow, you know, because, you know, mess with me, will ya, you know, and here we are. You know, and I mean, here we are 3 months into our marriage, you know, and already, you know, this is the insidiousness of the disease of alcoholism, and I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. Because as we're going along the road, in the very beginning, his wrongs are huge. Spends whole paychecks on drugs and alcohol. We have all kinds of financial problems because of his drug use and alcohol use, you know. And his wrongs are really like this. All the time, they are like this. You know, in the beginning, I really believed that mine kind of started out like this. But it wasn't very long before how the disease of alcoholism affected me, the non-drinker, that my wrongs got to be just as big. But because they just kind of grew along, I gradually lost sight of the fact that, both of the things we were doing wrong in our marriage, wrong in our family, wrong in the way that we treat each other, were just as big. But again, I'm suffering from the illusion that I'm not the one. I'm not the problem. He's the problem. And when you're always looking at somebody else and what somebody else is doing, you miss yourself. You miss yourself and you miss what you're doing. You know, and that's what slowly started happening to me. And all I could see was that I was doing all the good stuff. I was going to work. I was taking care of the kids. I was holding it all together. You know, I didn't see how I was yelling and screaming and ranting and raving and taking a bad situation and just pouring salt on it. You know, I could tell I would look at my husband and be yelling and screaming at him and making him feel very, very badly for what he had done in his behavior. And I could look in his eyes and I could see the remorse and I could see how badly he felt about himself as a person. You know, and knowing that the message was there and that he knew, you know, and that he was remorseful, how much more do you have to push somebody? But again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, it was good. I've got him where I want him now. Now let's just put the nail in the heart. And every so often I would hear the little voice in the back of my head just say, you know, you don't need to say this anymore. You don't need to do this anymore. But I couldn't stop it. You know, it's a monster all its own. And I'm not the person that's drinking or doing drugs or anything. I'm the sober person in this relationship. You know, and this is the monster that's coming out of me. Again, how I've been affected by the disease of alcoholism and I'm not even the person that's drinking. You know, and one time I got this call from Butch's friends that I affectionately refer to as scum of the earth people, and these were drug dealers, heavy-duty drug dealer people, and my husband was so drunk and so loaded over at their house and such a pig and such a slob and just so out of it that these people, the drug dealers, were going to call the police if I didn't come get him. I mean, that's just how bad he was. So I go over to get him, and you know, and they've kicked him out of the house. He's in the bushes in the front lawn there, you know. And so, you know, I got him up, and I just pushed him, and he landed in the back seat of the car. And I drove home, and I went to go put our son up in his crib, and I come down to get my husband, and he's made the fatal mistake of trying to get out of the car without my help, and he's fallen into the street and hit his head on the, you know, the curb, and blood's gushing out all over the place. And I'd like to tell you how concerned I was about his well-being, but I wasn't. My only concern was getting him up before anybody saw him out there. You know, but of course, you know, at this point, he's like, almost 200 pounds of wet washcloth. You know, I couldn't even hardly do anything with him. So, and he's bleeding out of his head profusely. So I grab him by the ankles, and I'm trying to heave him up over the curb to take him down the walkway and sneak him in the house. And this guy drives by. Now, why we call these people normies, I have not a flaming clue. I've got a guy on the ground, bleeding out of his head, by the ankles, heaving up over the curb, and this guy stops his car and says, "Are you having a problem?" This is what the normal people say, you know? And I go, "Yes, my husband's fallen and he can't get up." And the guy insists on helping me, and we get him up, and we lived in a townhouse, and our bedroom was upstairs, and I have to have him in the bed because he's injured, and that's where he needs to be. And so we're taking him up a whole flight of stairs, and now, of course, the words are flying between him and I, and Mr. Good Samaritan doesn't want to be Mr. Helpful anymore. He just wants out of there, and we get to the top of the stairs, and he's out of there like a bullet, you know, and Butch falls on the bed. Now the whole bed spread. The blood's just spreading out across, you know, it's just gushing out. I'm hysterical now. I don't know what to do. You know, I'm brain injury. His brains are coming out of the back, I'm sure. I'm so hysterical, I dial 911. They don't know what's going on. They send a hook and ladder truck, the police, everything they got. They even got a hold of my mother, you know. And then I'm in the baby's bedroom with the baby, oh, patting the baby, oh, crying. Oh, my mom's trying to console me. And the Redondo Beach police come in, and they say, "Mrs. Gantner, your husband said he cracked his head open because you pushed him down a flight of stairs." You know. And I told them I didn't do that, but if they'd pop him up, I'd be happy to push him down in front of the Redondo Beach Police Department. You know, and they told me that wouldn't be necessary, and they clean him all up, you know, and it turns out he's a little weenie cut, only needs 4 or 5 stitches, but he's so drunk he can't walk, you know, so they got to take him by ambulance. Now, I don't know how your neighborhood is, but 5 o'clock, hook and ladder truck in the front of my house, all the neighbors were standing out there. Here comes Butch on the gurney. "Hiya, Frank. Hiya, Joe," you know. His usual friendly, wonderful self. I come out behind a newspaper like they won't know it's me. you know, because I'm real big into anonymity at this point. You know, and again, and somewhere in all this insanity, you know, I got pregnant with the second child. We had a boy, and I don't know what happened this particular day, and don't ask what made me do it, but I picked up the phone and I called the Council on Alcoholism, and asked them, you know, told them, you know, the stuff that was going on in my house. And no matter what I would say to this woman who answered the phone, all she would say was, "I know." You know, I told her about the financial, the fighting, the drinking, the drugs, the no money for this, you know, how crazy I was, how crazy he was. All she would say is, "I know, I know, I know, I know." And I know that she asked me for my address and asked if she could send me some Al-Anon literature. I told her that she could, and I remember the envelope coming. But that, to this day, that's all I remember. I can't tell you if I opened it, if I looked at it, or what. Total whiteout. For me, I just have absolutely no recollection. You know, but the first attempt that I made to try and start looking at the drinking. Because see, for me, you know, again, knowledge, you know, from nowhere. Because I can take a drink or not take a drink. It don't matter to me one little bit. And if I can take a drink or not take a drink, then you tell me why you can't take a drink or not take a drink. You know, so therefore he was drinking at me. He was drinking, having a good time. He never came home looking like he was having a good time. He always came home looking like he'd been run over by a Mack truck. But again, I get information from nowhere and it becomes fact for me. He drinks because he wants to drink. And again, sometime in all this insanity, I went to my very first Al-Anon meeting. A friend of mine that I had gone to school with, I know that her mother had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and that her dad was going to Al-Anon. And so I asked Crazy Jean to take me to my first Al-Anon meeting. And I went to that meeting and it was a wonderful meeting, wonderful literature, all the stuff you're looking for, you know. But, you know, again, they didn't have the piece of literature I wanted. And that's how to get them to stop drinking and do what you want them to do. Because, see, that's all I was interested in. They wanted to talk to me about what I could do for me and my family. You know, and I didn't want to hear it because it wasn't my fault. You fix him and I'll be okay. You know, and I'm telling you, when I was sitting at that meeting, you know, if they said, "Larsine, did you want your life to be different?" God, did I want my life to be different. I couldn't stand my life. I hated my life. I hated everything and anything that was even around me because of how I'd been affected by the disease of alcoholism. But, "Larsine, what are you willing to do to make your life different?" See, and I wasn't willing to do anything. You know, and I'm here to tell you that if you're not willing to do anything different, how can you possibly expect anything to change? And that's how I sat in that meeting, unwilling, totally unwilling to do anything except blame other people. And so anyway, that was my Al-Anon career, and then just right back into it again. And, you know, and just to kind of wrap up the whole drinking deal, you know, I remember at the very end of my husband's drinking, you know, and we're standing there and we're toe-to-toe. And I'm getting in a big old fight with him. And now I'm, you know, because all I know to do is push harder. I just know how to push harder. So I'm sitting there poking him in the chest, egging him to hit me. "Let's just take it to the next level. I know you want to hit me. Let's just go there." And then I became very conscious of our two little boys who at that point were 5 and 3 years old. And they're standing on either side of me. And I feel these little boys tugging on my pant legs. And I look down and these little boys are crying. "Please, Mommy, please stop yelling at Daddy." And I'd like to tell you I had a moment of clarity there, but I did not. I tell you what I did. I looked down at those little boys and I started yelling at them. "How dare they tell me to stop yelling at their dad? He's the reason we're in this situation. He's the reason our life sucks and everybody hates us and we hate everybody and blah, 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 blah." And when I get done looking and yelling at these little boys, I look up and I watch their drunken, loaded father walking out the front door. And I, the sober mother, say to the drunken father, "Where the hell do you think you're going?" And the sober or the drunken dad turns around to the sober mom and says, "I'm leaving because we're upsetting the children." And I don't tell you this story because I'm proud of it. I tell you this story because this is where the disease of alcoholism took me, and I'm not even the person that's drinking, and I think I'm the one that's holding it together. I think I'm the brave one. I'm the one. I'm the martyr. I should be a saint for what I'm putting up with and doing. And all I have is nothing but crap coming out. Nothing but crap coming out. And I'm here to tell you that all the yelling and screaming, when I think back on it now, it never brought me 1 ounce of joy, not 1 ounce of relief, just more pain. Just more pain, more tears, more hurt. And again, the disease of alcoholism and how we're affected. I don't know how long it was after that that my husband ended up getting sober. After he went off the Anabuse and started drinking again, I think he drank about 9 more months. You know, and that whole thing for him was a total blackout, and for me, just a total whiteout. I used to come home and pray that his truck would be home. I was coming home now praying it wouldn't, because I just couldn't deal with it anymore. The Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality, it was absolutely crazy. And I'd come home and he'd be passed out on the kitchen floor, you know, and I'd be afraid he'd be slipping into a coma for all the drugs he was using. And I keep checking his pulse and not know what to do. You know, and all the while I think I'm protecting my kids from this, and my kids were so wonderful with him. They really were. Like I say, my husband wasn't a violent guy at all. He'd be passed out on the floor. The boys would build Tinker Toy bridges over him, you know, tie Tonka trucks to him. They pretended he was Gulliver all the time, you know, and, you know, and they just, you know, they, it was their dad, and they loved him, you know, and that's just kind of the way that it was for him, and, you know, and when, you know, my husband's last drunk, you know, why that's the one that got him sober, I have no idea. On a scale of 1 to 10, I wouldn't give his last drunk a 5, but, you know, that's the one that got him sober, and, you know, and that's his miracle. I believe that that night that God started working in my husband's life, even though I don't believe that God was working in mine, I believe he was working in my husband's life. You know, someone had given me the number of a hospital that they had just opened, and that treated alcoholism, and I called and got the number of the doctor that was there and talked to the doctor, and he said I could have my husband committed if he was drunk, but that after, you know, he sobered up, if he didn't want to stay, he didn't have to, because they wanted people that wanted to get well, not people that just needed to be committed. And so I thanked them and I hung up the phone, and that night he got arrested. And it's no big deal in my house. My husband's been arrested many, many times. But that next day when I went to go pick him up from jail, there was something different about him. I knew it right away. Don't ask me what. But the most amazing thing that happened at all is that when I picked him up, I said absolutely nothing. And believe you me, it takes a power greater than anything you've seen on the face of this earth to keep my mouth shut. And I said nothing. I couldn't even believe driving him home. Nothing, nothing. And then he lost his truck, which is one, I don't know if any of you have been truck hunting before. You know, I think it should be an Al-Anon Olympic event. But we went truck hunting, found his truck again. I said nothing. We went home. He went upstairs, stayed upstairs for 2 days. I said nothing, didn't bang a pot, slam a door, nothing. And when he came down after, you know, 2 days, he comes downstairs, and to me, the understatement of the year, Larsine, I think I've got a problem. No shit, Sherlock, yeah. You know, and so I gave him, you know, and again, God working in his life, not in mine. I just handed him the number of the hospital. You know, and it's my MO. I do everything. I did nothing. I handed him the number and I left the room. He made the arrangements. He made the phone calls. He got himself into this hospital, and he had to go into the psychiatric unit first because he's been taking Valium for 100 years and everything else and going through the DT, so they had to totally detox him. And I remember as I was getting to the end of the hallway and I was leaving him, you know, and he was going to be there for however long he had to be there, I got to the end of the big double doors at the end, and then he says, Larsine, you know, and I turn around because I'm sure he changed his mind and didn't want him to stay, and that was fine with me because I wasn't too thrilled about leaving him in a psychiatric hospital. What would the neighbor say? And instead, when I got back to him, he reached into his pocket and he handed me the Valium that he brought in case of emergency. You know, and he'd never parted with a Valium in his life. You know, and I knew things were going to be different. Now, I went home and I took that Valium because I was just a flaming basket case. The best night's sleep I ever had. And he was in the psychiatric unit. Now, I got a husband in the psychiatric unit. I got a son in kindergarten and one in preschool. Now, to cheer Butch up, I would, you know, take to him, you know, what, you know, show him what the kids had made in preschool and kindergarten. But oh no, he wanted to show me what he made in occupational therapy that day, you know. And I'd take it home and show the boys. We'd hang it on the refrigerator. We're so proud. Look what Daddy's doing. Yay! Sober's going to be fun, you know. And just absolutely crazy. And but after he was in there a couple of weeks, and then they transferred him to the alcoholics, you know, portion of the alcoholism side of that hospital, you know, and I am, you know, pleased to report to you that this last July 21st, my husband celebrated 23 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you. And my heart knows no end of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous, absolutely no end of gratitude. My husband was close to death when he got here. I have absolutely no doubt about that. And I'm not crying because, you know, he almost died, because I was rooting for death myself. You know, I cry because I think about if he had died, I just know what an angry, violent person I was at that point. And I think about raising a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. without that, because I don't think I would have made it here. I just don't think I would have. I don't know for sure, but anyway, that's what my tears are really of, you know. And I love my husband. He's a wonderful man, and because of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, he has a wonderful life, and you know, and he owes his life to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know that, and my gratitude knows absolutely no bounds about it. I'm sorry he couldn't be here. He usually comes with me when he can, but he told me to tell you that he sends his very best, and that would be me. Anyway, he does send his love. But anyway, so he's in this hospital, and so they transfer him to the alcoholic side, and boy, he's all into AA and loving AA, and they didn't have any family, nothing back then. Nothing. You know, it was just, you should go to a Al-Anon meeting. Well, I'm a rule and regulation person, so I go to a Al-Anon meeting. You know, and my attitude at that meeting is, you know, I came to you guys like 3 years ago, asked you how to get my husband sober. You told me nothing. You know, and now I'm not going to tell you how I got him sober. You know, I mean, if you go figure it out yourself. You know, now I wasn't quite sure what I'd done to get him sober, but I was fully ready to take every bit of, you know, credit for that, because I knew some combination of mother and you know what and poisoning him and kicking him and yelling at him had to definitely have contributed to this man's sobriety. And I just wasn't sure what order I'd done it in that finally, you know, what was the kicker there. But anyway, so after he's in the hospital 5 weeks, whatever it was, he comes home, and now he's going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I'm a very helpful, loving wife. I go with him the first 6 months to make sure he hears the stuff he's supposed to hear. You know, but after 6 months, I don't know about you, but I got tired of going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, geez, how stupid are you? There's only 12 steps, you know, get on with it. You know, I've done them 6 times myself already here. Let's go, you know, and, you know, but no, no, AA, oh, AA, we love AA, you know, and AA's it. No, AA's the most important thing in my life. And no, oh, I just love to hear that. And, you know, I mean, the sponsor, oh, yeah, go home and tell your wife that. She'll just love it, you know. And so I just quit going with them to AA, and I started distancing myself because I didn't like it. I liked it that my husband was sober, but I didn't like it that he was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I want him to get sober and stay home and do what I wanted him to do. That's what I wanted. Then after he's sober 6 months, he starts saying stuff to me like, how much money is in the checking account? Like it's any of his business, you know. I mean, you know, he wants to participate actively in raising our children, like that's any of his concern, you know. I mean, this was my territory, and I was getting really scared. You know, he's starting to want to do some of the stuff that I do. And it's like my friend, you know, Crazy Jean says, you know, I was going nuts. I was just going absolutely crazy behind it. You know, and what was happening is that my husband was becoming this really nice guy, and he was working and doing all the stuff and doing the stuff he was supposed to be doing, and I didn't know how to deal with it, you know, because the deal was is I didn't know how to turn the anger off. I know how to be mad at him. I know how to blame him for everything that's going on. But now that he's starting to do the right things, this has put a whole new twist on the deal, and I don't know what my part is in this anymore. Because as much as I went to Open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and as many times as they made me feel welcome, and they always did at Open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I am not an alcoholic, and my recovery does not lie in the room of AA. My recovery lies in the room of the Al-Anon family groups, because I am a family member of a person who drinks. And this is where it is for me. And though I much enjoyed the stories and the camaraderie and the love, and I've learned many, many things at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, my recovery lies here, not there. And going to AA meetings, I didn't get well going to AA meetings. I had to go to Al-Anon meetings, but I did not know that. Because again, I'm in denial that I've been affected by the disease of alcoholism, because that's the way the disease works. It doesn't want you to know you got it. That's how it keeps on going and going and going and going. But anyway, it's like my friend Crazy Jean says, they get sober and you're out of a job. And that's just what it was for me. You know, I just didn't know where to go and how to go. And, you know, and I'd be losing my temper at home and flying off the handle over this minor infractions, just going absolutely nuts. And my husband's response would be, Larsine, you should let go and let God. You know, Larsine, you should turn it over. Larsine, easy does it. You know, I wanted to take a wooden spoon and just stab it right through his heart when we were standing there in the kitchen, you know, because it's just like all of a sudden he's the good guy and I don't know how to turn it off. after he was sober for almost 2 years, I went with him to a conference, never been before, and at this conference he tricked me into going to the family meeting where they had an Al-Anon speaker, an Alateen speaker, and an AA speaker. You know, what happened for me in that room was that day was that I became this much willing. God, it was only this much, but this much willing to do something different. So when I came back from that conference, I started going to Al-Anon for all the right reasons. I didn't come to get an alcoholic sober. He was already fine on his own. I didn't come to keep him sober. He's already sober 2 years at that point. He was doing just great, you know, wonderful. I came because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. When I came to my first Al-Anon meeting, they said, we work the steps, we get a sponsor, we go to meetings, we read the literature, hallelujah, I'm a rule and regulation person, sign me up. You know, I got a sponsor right away. I didn't wait around, you know, people, I'm amazed, people at Al-Anon so long still don't have a sponsor because they're looking for somebody just like them. How stupid can you be, God? Why do you want somebody just like you? Then she'll know what you're thinking. That's ridiculous. You know, you need an edge, especially on a sponsor, you know, and I don't want her to know what I'm thinking. So I got a sponsor who was older than my mother, never been had sobriety in her home, divorced from her alcoholic, didn't have any children, had a real thick Dutch accent, you could hardly understand a word she said. This is who I picked for my sponsor. Very first time I used her as a sponsor. I run upstairs, you know, well, what happened was my husband had a dead battery, and I went outside to jump it, and after I jumped it, he ran out of gas. And then this made him angry, and he yelled. Now, that's okay, that'll make anybody angry, and it's okay to yell, just not live there for 17,000 years. But he yelled, and I did what I always do. I yelled right back at him. And then he stormed off to work. I ran upstairs, called my sponsor, and reported his behavior. Told her exactly what had happened that day. And she says, when Butch gets home tonight, you tell him, you know, that you're sorry for what you said. You owe him an amends. You know, and I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, Jeannie missed the crucial who started it, which I always think is so important, you know. And she's not from America, you know, and stuff. So she, you know, it's a lot of things she doesn't understand about the wife-man thing here. So I didn't want to tell her. I thought she was totally stupid. So I started to tell her the story again. She obviously wasn't listening the first time around, you know. So halfway through the second telling, she goes, don't repeat the story. I heard you the first time. And another thing, don't you ever, ever call me again and start a conversation with Butch said or Butch did. I am not Butch's sponsor. I am Larsine's sponsor. And for what Larsine says, she owes her husband an amends. I'll see you at the meeting. Goodbye, click, end of conversation. Valuable lessons, never call your sponsor first thing in the morning. You got all day long to think about what she told you, you know. Never call your sponsor when you're going to see her that night at a meeting because she's going to want to know if you follow direction. I'm a rule and regulation person. I have no choice. I have to do it. So that night when Butch got home after stewing about it all day long, I told him I was sorry that I let his shitty attitude affect me the way that it had, and I would try and do better in the future. Now, I know that's not the best amends you can make. You know, today I know that. But see, what you got to know is that day is that I was this much willing to do something different. Because see, before I'd never told him I was sorry for nothing. It was always his fault. It's always his fault. You know, but I was this much willing, and I'm here to tell you that if you are just this much willing, that's all you got to be. And after a while, this much gets to this much, gets to this much, gets to this much, and then you start to see the changes in your life. But people beat themselves out of Al-Anon all the time because it's not changing fast enough. Nowhere in our literature does it say anything about fast. We just do it to the best of our ability one day at a time. Every morning, all I get up and all I ask is for just this much willingness. That's all I need every single day, and God will take me there. And he always has from that day to this day, pretty much, without fail. You know how I got a God here? I didn't want a God, didn't believe in God. You know, I gave God many, many opportunities to prove himself to me. If there's a God, why is it so hard for him to make an alcoholic walk in the door right now? I mean, I would say that to God. Okay, God, if you're really there, make him walk in the door right now. God couldn't pull it off, not once. Not one time, you know, so that was my, okay, there's God for me thing, you know, and I spent a lot of time yelling at God and blaming God, and when I was having a hard time, you know, with the God concept, I went to this Wednesday night step study meeting, and one night, the meeting, and there's about 15, 16 people that go to this meeting regularly, shared about their God specifically for my benefit, so that I could find a God for me to understand. But as my usual arrogant, not willing to do things differently deal, at the end of the meeting, my friend Crazy Jean comes up to me and goes, Larsine, you know, did that help you? And you know, can you get a God from everybody sharing here, or at least a place to start come to find a higher power to take you through the steps? You know, and I'm like, well, no, Gene, I really appreciate everybody sharing, but I'm just not going to get the God thing. It's just not going to happen for me. And my friend Crazy Gene turned to me and he said, Larson, you know why God gave you ears. Gene was very hard on me lots of times, and I was sure he was going to say something stupid. And so in my usual sarcastic, whiny, snivelly, yeah, Gene, so I can hear what you guys are trying to tell me. And Gene goes, in most people's cases, that's true, but in your case, God gave you ears so you'd have something to hold on to while you're pulling your head out of your ass. And you know, and that's where my head was, in perfect honesty. The whole God thing scared me to death, so I'm much more comfortable with my head up my ass, you know, than reaching out and trying. So I went home that night, stood in my backyard and said, God, this is Larson Gantner, gave him my address where we were living at the time. You know, and just said, this is where I live. I'm supposed to pray to you. I'm supposed to ask you for guidance. I haven't a clue how to start about it. I don't even know if you want to hear from me, but you got to show me the way to go. And just this much willingness from the very beginning. You know, now I go everywhere with God. He goes everywhere with me. Turns out I have a lot in common with God. You know, turns out we both love the same people a lot. You know, and that's the deal. So I turn them over to God because I figure he's maybe knows a little bit better than I do about some stuff. So I just let him take care of the deal. You know, I just let him do the deal for me one day at a time. You know, I'm just going to close with this story just so you know I'm not perfect, in case you might be thinking that maybe I was. I always like to close with this story. I was maybe at this point 17 years into Al-Anon, and my husband and I had been to this conference, just having the best time of our life, just a great conference, wonderful speakers, terrific workshops, just, you know, we come home Sunday, and if you've ever been to them, you know, and you just feel so wonderful, you know, you kind of float in the door, serenity coming out of every orifice of your body, you know, you just, ooh, the 12 steps, ooh, the traditions, ooh, the concepts, everything is wonderful, you know, and it was just like, and I keep a treadmill in the garage, and that's my exercise, and so when I get home right away, that's what I want to do, and so I put on my walking clothes and go to walk on my treadmill, and then my son, our youngest son, who at that time was about 20 years old, living at home still, he has a weight bench next to my treadmill, and as I go to walk in there, there's this weight bench, and on this weight bench is a driver's license. Now, I pick up this driver's license, and I can immediately tell from the date of birth that this woman is 32 years old, lives in Glendora, and then I immediately deduce that she's been in my house over the weekend, had sex with my 20-year-old son, wants to marry him, has two kids, and call me mom. You know, I am there right now, you know, and I mean, so I go running into the house, and there's Butch, he's laying on the couch, his favorite form of exercise, and I lay the driver's license on the coffee table in front of him, and he looks at me like, what? You know, because he's got no imagination whatsoever, nothing. And so I tell him my story, what I think has happened. Again, information from nowhere that lands here that becomes fact for me. You know, his eyes roll back in his head, you know, and he goes, Larson, will you shut up? Just go call, Carol's my sponsor. Go call Carol right now. So I go pick up the phone, call Carol, tell her what I think has happened over the weekend. Carol agrees with Butch. I am flipped out nuts. And Carol rarely specifically tells me anything to do, but that day she said to me, when that kid comes home, you shut up. Don't you dare say one word to him about what crap you think went on this house over the weekend. You've made it all up in your head. Don't you dare say a word to him. So I hang up the phone. Now, as it turns out, I don't see my son, you know, that day. We're on very different schedules, his school, his work, my work, you know. And as it turns out, I don't see him for two more days. And then by the time two more days has rolled by, many other information from nowhere has landed here. I've been through many other crises, and I forget about the driver's license. So he walks in the kitchen, and he's got the driver's license in his hand, and he says, Mom, what do you do when you find a driver's license? You know? Now, I don't tell him what I do when I find a driver's license, because that's not a good example. See, but the difference for me, the before and after, you know, what Al-Anon has given me, you know, 3 seconds to go, God help me, call my sponsor, and run the crap that's going on in my head past a sane person. And then they turn that back around to me, and what Carol gave me was that she didn't let me project the fear I had for my son back onto him. You know, my son has some problems with alcohol and drugs, and I don't have time to go into that story or whatever, you know, but he's doing fine one day at a time, and that's his deal, and I don't get to call him an alcoholic or not. I just know that the things that he does bother me, and now I have a program to come to, and that's Al-Anon. But left alone, I will think up the worst stuff. I am a fearfully based person, and that's all I have is a lot of fear about that kid, so that everything I find, again, the negative disease of alcoholism takes me to the bad place right away. But because I had a sponsor to call, and because I ran it past her, and because I didn't say anything to that kid and make him feel bad about himself, about something he didn't even do, just because I'm the one that's full of fear. Someone told me that what fear stands for is forgetting everything is all right. You know, and right then and there, everything was just fine. But I will go to the bad place. 17 years in Al-Anon, working the steps, having a sponsor, going to meetings. That's why I got to keep coming back, because I live with me 24/7. This head is constantly going. But I have literature to read, meetings to go to, sponsorship. It amazes me that I had to come to a room full of strangers to learn how to love my own family. But I do. You know, and because of you, that son who's now 25 can come home and talk to his mom anytime and knows that I love him unconditionally. I still worry about him all the time, but by God, if I'm going to send vibes his way, why don't I send positive ones? Why don't I ask God to watch out for him rather than stick all the fear and all the worry and stuff like that? You know, and because of my ability to be able to do that, because you guys have given me that gift, you know, I can get on a plane and come out to Atlanta, Georgia and be with you guys, you know, and know that God's watching over him just like he's watching over me, just like he's watching over you and your family and your kids, like it goes on all the time. Not to say that anything bad won't happen. I don't know that it will, but right now everything's all right. I better enjoy it because I'm living in the now. I can't live in the past and I can't live in the future. God's in the present. That's where he is right now. It's so important for me to stay here. I don't want to miss it. I've got a little tiny wooden candle in my house, and it's got a little bitty wooden block. And on the block it says, the candle loses nothing of its light by lighting another candle. I want to thank you guys with all my heart for lighting my candle. Told you.